stopping machinery, each one enclosed behind 3 inches of what seemed to be bulletproof glass. The large metal donut sat in the center of it all. Riley walked over to Emerson. He was staring at a big red button on the wall. "Emerson, you're not thinking about pushing that button, are you?" Emerson continued to stare at the button.
"I was giving it some serious consideration."
Riley grabbed him by the arm. "Remember when you once told me it was your life's ambition to avoid terrible ideas?"
"Of course."
"Well, I'm telling you that anytime there's a big red button and you don't know what it does, it's a really awful decision to push it."
"The problem is that is exactly what the button wants you to think. I think we should push it."
"No." Emerson looked over toward the front door.
"Is someone coming back?"
Riley turned to look, and the white milky glass tile she was standing upon turned clear, revealing a swirling, swimming pool-sized pit of boiling red magma beneath her feet.
"Holy crap," Riley said. "What the heck?"
Emerson stared at the magma.
"Well, that's something you don't see every day. The floor must be made of electric glass."
Riley cut her eyes to Emerson. "You pushed the red button when I wasn't looking, didn't you?"
"I suppose you wouldn't believe me if I said no," Emerson said.
"Try me." Emerson looked at Riley.
"No."
Riley shook her head.
"I don't believe you."
"What was I supposed to do?" Emerson said. "It's a big red button."
Riley threw her arms up in the air. "For the love of Mike, Emerson, why can't you just be the sort of guy who leaves his shoes all over the house or can never find his car keys? I just don't think I'm the sort of woman who can ever be with a guy who goes around just willy-nilly pushing red buttons."
"I propose a compromise," Emerson said. "I'll continue to push big red buttons, just not in a willy-nilly fashion."
He looked at her for a long moment.
"About the button pushing and stuff, are you considering a relationship with me?"
Maybe. I mean, I am your amanuensis. Are you considering a relationship with me?"
"It's crossed my mind," Emerson said.
"Is it because you saw me naked?"
"Not entirely, but I think about it a lot."
"In a good way?"
"Sort of in a Vernon way," Emerson said.
"Vernon is a horn dog."
"I might also be one."
Riley had no idea where to go with this. She supposed she was happy Emerson was attracted to her, but she didn't know about him being a horn dog. A horn dog didn't exactly describe the man of her dreams.
"We should get on with it," Riley said.
Emerson nodded.
"My exact thought."
He walked the perimeter of the pit. It was almost as big as the warehouse itself.
"It's a platinum swimming pool filled with lava," Emerson said. "There's even an intake pipe where the lava gets pumped in, presumably from the drills outside, and an outtake. I'm guessing it eventually gets returned to flow underground."
Riley thought that made sense. There wasn't any evidence in the area of lava being dumped above ground. "Why aren't the glass tiles melting?" she asked. Emerson got down on his knees and examined the floor.
"It's not glass. It's some kind of a transparent ceramic. It's an excellent insulator, so it protects us from the heat, and obviously it won't melt unless temperatures reach well above 5,000 degrees.
"Is transparent ceramic a real thing?" Riley asked.
"It's a technology used in products ranging from clear orthodontic braces to armored car windows. I've never heard of anybody using it for a swimming pool cover. Of course, I've never heard of a swimming pool filled with lava, either."
One of the larger machines on the other side of the room lit up, and a steady stream of magma filled its transparent ceramic enclosure. The robotic arms inside went into operation, pushing the lava through a filter and separating it into different portions. The smaller portion was transferred to another enclosure, where robotic arms again went to work. The larger portion was flushed underground, where it gurgled as it moved through the plumbing, eventually flowing outside and away from the warehouse. Riley watched the robotic arms busy at work.
"They're looking for something in the lava, aren't they?"
Emerson nodded.
"Definitely. Something much more valuable than money. Something worth killing over. Something that the government's been protecting and keeping secret for more than a century."
They heard the sound of voices outside the warehouse, and the front entrance clicked open. Emerson pushed the red button,
and the magma swimming pool disappeared behind the milky white floor. He grabbed Riley by the wrist and yanked her to a dark corner of the warehouse where a large tarp covered an unused piece of heavy machinery. Riley and Emerson hid under the tarp and listened as the door opened and the voices filled the room. Riley peered out from under the tarp. Tin Man, Eugene Spiro, and Bart Young were standing next to the large metal donut in the center of the room. Bart Young pointed at the smaller version of the donut.
"Move everything into the portable penning trap."
Spiro attached the smaller trap to the larger one using a coupling.
"You're taking all of it? Where?"
"We have a parallel program in Hawaii," the director said. "We can't find Knight, and I'm not risking leaving any loose ends in light of how close we are to finishing. After today, it's none of your concern."
Spiro went to one of the workstations and sat down in front of one of the computers. He typed in some instructions, and the smaller penning trap powered up.
"It will take a couple minutes for the transfer to be complete," he said to the director. "How are you going to get it safely to Hawaii? You know how a penning trap works, don't you? It uses the magnetic field to store and isolate charged matter."
"Your point being," the director said.
"The point being that if you get a little unlucky and there's a power interruption, then there's no more magnetic field."
"And?" Tin Man asked.
"No more magnetic field means that what's inside isn't isolated from the matter outside this canister," Spiro said. "And if that happens, we're all in a world of pain."
"Again, no longer your concern," the director said.
"I've spent 10 years of my life developing this program," Spiro said. "I don't want to see it fail."
"This is not your program," the director said. "You are an employee, and you should be very careful, because I'm not impressed with your performance. 10 years have passed, and you've only managed to collect a couple ounces."
"That's enough to obliterate a continent. How much more do you need?"
The director shrugged.
"More."
"Collection is difficult. It takes time," Spiro said.
"You are no longer credible," the director said. "It was your call to leave Knight alone. If I had listened to Tin Man in the first place, I wouldn't be thinking about destroying a $2 trillion facility, and you wouldn't be out of a job."
Spiro looked relieved that he was only fired. The penalty could have been much worse.
"Why would this have to be destroyed?" Spiro asked.
"Knight has money, and he knows powerful people," the director said. "He also has a blog that's read by thousands. If he learns enough and goes public with it, we'll have all sorts of idiots crawling all over this facility. We won't be able to kill them fast enough. Everyone from conspiracy theorists to Sunday hikers to political watchdogs will be here. Our plans will be savaged, and our technology will be discovered and stolen."
Spiro shook his head.
"It will take a year to dismantle."
"On the contrary, one well-placed tactical nuclear device detonated in the underground lava lake beneath the dome should do the trick. The entire area will be buried under 50 feet of magma in no more than a day."
Spiro went pale.
"It would destabilize the entire supervolcano. The entire park, not just the dome, could be buried under 50 feet of magma. If that happened, it could kill millions."
Tin Man smiled. "I knew there was a silver lining. I almost hope we don't find Night and Moon."
The director turned to Tin Man.
"Always the optimist. From here on out, you're in charge of Yellowstone. If you don't find Night and Moon in a week, or if there's even a whisper about Sour Creek Dome on his blog, detonate the nuke."
The little penning trap beeped, and the green light on its side changed from blinking to solid.
"The transfer is done," Spiro said. "I'll get someone to help us move it to the transport."
Tin Man watched Spiro leave the warehouse.
"You're not taking him with us?" "He's leaving with us, but he won't be walking off the plane in Hawaii. You know how I hate loose ends."
Chapter 19. Emerson and Riley watched from their hiding place until the guards left with a portable penning trap, and the room was empty.
"Wow," Riley said. "What do you think they've got in that thing?"
Emerson opened the warehouse's back door a crack and peeked out. There was still a guard hanging around.
"I don't know,
The concept of a penning trap has been around since 1923.
You don't know enough to leave red buttons alone, but you know what year the penning trap was invented?
Hans Demult won the Nobel Prize in Physics for its invention in 1989. It made a major impact in my life.
You wanted to be a physicist?
No, I wanted to be Captain Kirk. The penning trap is basically a vacuum environment capable of containing charged antimatter in a magnetic prison. Antimatter is what makes warp speed possible, without which the Starship Enterprise could never have explored strange new worlds.
Could they be harvesting antimatter?
Emerson shook his head. The universe is composed of nearly 50% antimatter. If you wanted to get your hands on some, you wouldn't have to tap into the Earth's core. Besides, a penning trap that size wouldn't hold enough to destroy this compound, let alone a continent.
What else can a penning trap hold?
Plasmas.
Let's pretend I don't know anything about physics or Star Trek.
There are four types of ordinary matter: solids, liquids, gases, and plasmas. Plasmas are the only type of matter that doesn't naturally exist on the Earth under normal surface conditions. They're basically created from neutral gases, like hydrogen, by ionizing them and giving them an electrical charge. Lightning, neon signs, television screens, and the aurora borealis are all examples.
So, are plasmas rare? Could that be what they're collecting? Riley asked.
Emerson peeked out the door again. The guard was gone. Plasmas are the most common type of ordinary matter in existence, Emerson said. The sun and stars are all basically superheated balls of plasma. Plasmas are kind of the building blocks of the universe.
Riley and Emerson walked out into the cold night air and skirted around the perimeter of the compound. There was a lot of activity, but all the attention was focused on the transport and Humvee idling in front of the warehouse.
This is it, Emerson said. We are not going to find a better time than this to make our escape.
They sprinted to the surrounding woods, and Riley breathed a sigh of relief when they were hidden from sight. How far do you think it is back the gatehouse?
Not far, maybe a mile or two. It's going to be slow going in the dark, though. I saw a lot of thermal features on the way in. I don't want to accidentally fall into any pools of boiling water.
They trudged along the jeep trail in silence for several minutes. You know, Emerson, something you said back in the compound reminds me of something Professor White told us back at George Mason University.
What's that?
The plasmas form the building blocks of the universe, Riley said. Didn't the professor say that mantle plumes contain trace amounts of cosmic leftovers, the same materials that formed the stars before the Earth was created? She said they were a clue to the forces of creation.
Emerson stopped and stared at Riley. I'm promoting you to senior amanuensis, effective immediately, for having invaluable insight and a brilliant memory.
Thank you, Riley said.
And because you look good naked,
Emerson added. Would I still get the promotion if I didn't look good naked?
Yes, but you might not get the additional benefits.
Now that Riley knew Emerson was possibly a horn dog, she had some idea of the benefits. She felt a rush of heat curl through her stomach and head south. Good to know, Riley said. Do you know what's in the penning trap?
No, not exactly, but I have a theory. I think it's some cosmic remnant from the swirling nebula of stellar gases that formed our solar system 4.5 billion years ago. Some very rare, very dangerous primordial element that can only be found at the Earth's core. And every once in a rare while, a little bit of it bubbles to the surface, courtesy of a mantle plume volcano.
A diesel engine rumbled from the direction of the compound.
It's the transport, Emerson said. They're heading out.
Emerson and Riley ran for cover, flattening themselves under a clump of scrub brush. Lights flashed onto the road, and the Humvee appeared, followed by the transport. Tin Man was standing in the back cargo bed of the Humvee, methodically shining a spotlight into the woods, first to one side, then the other. They're looking for us, Riley whispered to Emerson. We must have been spotted leaving the compound.
They're looking for something, Emerson said. Whether it is us or not is unclear at this time.
Tin Man played the light across their bush. Riley held her breath, and the light moved on.
The Humvee and transport slowly drove another 100 feet down the road before Tin Man said something into a walkie-talkie and the convoy abruptly stopped. Tin Man hopped off the Humvee, opened the rear passenger door, and dragged Spiro out of the vehicle and onto the road. Spiro was babbling, and when he passed in front of the transport headlights, Riley could see that he was shaking. He stumbled and fell to his knees, but Tin Man yanked him to his feet and shoved him toward the woods. Spiro resisted, and Tin Man hit him hard on the side of his face. Spiro sobbed once and went silent. They disappeared into the woods, and Emerson moved out from under cover.
"Stay here," he said to Riley.
Riley grabbed Emerson by his shirt sleeve.
"Telling me to stay here implies that you're not."
"They're going to kill him," Emerson said. "I have to try to do something."
The sound of a brief struggle carried out of the woods. There was a sploosh, and then blood-curdling screaming. Tin Man reappeared, got back into the Humvee, and the convoy disappeared down the road. Emerson and Riley ran down the jeep trail toward the screaming. By the time they turned into the woods, the screams had turned into whimpers. The smell of rotten eggs hung heavy in the air. Directly in front of them, lit by moonlight, was a large, nasty-looking, steaming, bubbling mud pot.
"Spiro," Emerson shouted, "where are you?"
A mud-covered hand lifted in response. It was Spiro, lying half in and half out of the boiling, sulfuric mud hole. He was covered with the scorching brown sludge, making him almost indistinguishable from the surrounding dirt. Emerson knelt beside him.
"Hang on, we're going to get you out."
Spiro looked up and blinked. His skin was sloughing off his face, and his blood was mingling with the mud.
"Emerson Knight and Riley Moon, why are you here?"
"I told my friend I would find his island," Emerson said. "I have to know what happened."
"Mauna Kea," Spiro said.
"What's at Mauna Kea?" Riley asked. "What will we find there?"
Spiro closed his eyes and blew out his final breath of air.
"Armageddon."
It was 2 in the morning by the time Emerson and Riley got back to the gatehouse. The two guards were still half-naked and handcuffed to the wood stove. Vernon and Wayne Bagus still looked ridiculous in their ill-fitting uniforms and were playing cards. Vernon looked up.
"Boy, am I glad to see you. Little buddy cheat something fierce."
"I win only through my superior skills," Wayne Bagus said. "Vernon cannot concentrate." They walked outside so they could talk without the guards hearing.
"Did the Humvee and military transport come through here a couple hours ago?" Emerson asked.
Vernon nodded.
"Yep, didn't even stop to say howdy do. Little buddy and I just stayed in the hut. What'd you two find out? Did you bring me back a cheeseburger?"
"For starters, we're wanted fugitives," Riley said. "That's the good news. The bad news is that the insane director of the National Park Service is tapping into the Earth's core to gather materials for making some sort of super weapon."
"I'll just blow this whole thing wide open on the blog," Vernon said. "It'll get sorted out lickety-split once it's all over the internet."
"I guess I forgot to mention the hostages," Riley said.
"There is a hostage?" Wayne Bagus asked. "Try a million. Tin Man's gonna blow up Yellowstone if we say even a word to anybody about it."
"I don't see where that's a problem," Vernon said. "We evacuate all the people, and all's left to blow up are the stupid Bigfoots and stinkhole mud pots. I say good riddance."
"The park is a national treasure," Riley said.
"Treasure schmeasure," Vernon said.
Everyone was silent for a beat, thinking about it. "Off the table," Riley said. "We are not going to blow up Yellowstone."
"Of course not,"
Emerson said.
"Very, very bad karma," Wayne Bagus said. "The thought gives me a severe pain behind my eye."
"First things first," Emerson said. "We need to get out of the park."
He walked back inside the gatehouse and knelt down to talk with the guards.
"What do you say we make a bargain?"
Emerson asked them. 4 hours of being chained to a wood stove in their underwear had knocked a lot of the fight from the two guards.
"What kind of a bargain?" a guard asked.
The best kind, Emerson said, one that is mutually beneficial to both sides. We'll let you go and give you back your clothes.
Wayne Baggis tapped Emerson on the shoulder. I'm a little attached to the hat.
Except for the hat, Emerson said. They looked interested.
Okay, what do we have to do?
You drive us out of the park to the Bozeman Airport and forget you ever saw us.
Why would we agree to that? The first guard asked.
What do you think Tin Man would do to you if he knew you let us waltz into a top-secret government installation and steal national secrets?
The guards exchanged glances.
Good point, one said. Will you be needing an SUV or a sedan for your ride to the airport?
Riley settled into the plush leather seat of the Gulfstream G550 for the 7-hour flight to Kona, Hawaii. Didn't you have to file a flight plan with the FAA that includes all our names? Aren't you worried the police will be on the tarmac in Hawaii waiting for us when we land? Emerson handed Vernon a breadbasket and a tray of meats and cheeses from the cabin's refrigerator.
This isn't my personal plane, Emerson said. This is a private charter. I called the owner of the company, and he agreed to help us travel incognito. It took some time for him to get the plane to Bozeman, but it was worth the wait.
Are you talking about Warren Buffett? Riley asked. Emerson selected a piece of cheese from the tray.
Do you know Warren?
No, Riley said. Do you?
Of course, Emerson said. He's a super nice guy. Goes to bed at night and gets up in the morning just like everyone else. Of course, then he hops into a solid gold helicopter and goes to work in a Zeppelin made entirely from $100 bills.
Vernon nodded.
Well, personally, I don't much care for him, what with his quote-unquote relaxed island style and that song Margaritaville playing nonstop in every restaurant in Florida.
Riley rolled her eyes. That would be Jimmy Buffett. Warren Buffett's the businessman. Vernon paused.
Huh, no kidding. Does he have a relaxed island style?
Not that I know of, Emerson said.
Okay, great. Then I don't have a problem with him,
Vernon said, and he made himself a sandwich. Riley closed her eyes just for a moment, and when she opened them again, they were flying over the Pacific Ocean. Vernon and Wayne Baggis were sleeping. Emerson was on his laptop browsing the internet. So, how are you planning on finding Tin Man and Bart Young once we're in Hawaii? Riley asked Emerson. Emerson looked up from his laptop.
The director said he had a parallel program to Yellowstone in Hawaii. It has to be at one of the national parks. Either Volcanoes National Park on the Big Island, or Haleakala National Park on Maui.
And you think it's on the Big Island?
Spiro's last words were Mauna Kea. It's one of 5 volcanoes that form the Big Island. The others are Mauna Loa, Kilauea, Hualalai, and Kohala.
What's special about Mauna Kea? Riley asked.
It's the biggest mountain in Hawaii at more than 13,000 feet above sea level. Measured from the ocean floor, it's more than 33,000 feet high. That's bigger than Mount Everest. It's so massive that it depresses the ocean floor beneath the island by 6 kilometers. One day, eons from now, Hawaii will likely collapse under its own weight.
Is there a government installation on Mauna Kea?
Several, Emerson said. There's a complex of huge telescopes and observatories on the summit originally built by the U.S. Air Force, although today they're run by an international consortium. The lower elevations of the mountain are home to the 100,000-acre Pohakuloa training area, the largest military training ground in the Pacific.
And that's where you think Tin Man and the director are headed?
Emerson nodded. Pohakuloa is extremely remote. Access is restricted by the Army. It also has a small military airstrip called Bradshaw Army Airfield. It would be a perfect place to hide an R&D facility.
I assume you have a plan for what to do if and when we find them, Riley said. Emerson checked the flight computer.
1 hour until we land in Kona.
You don't have a plan, do you?
Of course, Emerson said. Break into the army base, steal the superweapon, save the world from destruction, kiss the girl, and live happily ever after. As far as the details go, I thought we would just woo-way wing it.
Would you like to elaborate on the kiss the girl part?
It's traditional to get a kiss when you save the world,
Emerson said. Riley smiled. Tell you what, you save the world, and I'll give you a kiss that will knock your socks off.
I get a blister if I don't wear socks,
Emerson said. Riley reclined her seat and closed her eyes. She was too tired to roll them. Wu-Wei, wake me up when we land. Chapter 20 Riley stepped off the plane onto the private runway at Kona International Airport. She pictured lush tropical rainforests set against a backdrop of white sandy beaches and blue ocean. The ocean was a brilliant, shimmering blue, but that's where her mental image ended. The paved runway was set in the middle of a huge lava desert that looked a lot like a massive torn-up parking lot. The beach was composed mostly of jagged black rocks. In the distance, a dull haze of volcanic gases hung over the mountains.
It looks kind of desolate, Riley said. I didn't expect to see so much lava.
This is the dry side of the island. Kona gets very little rain every year. The only green you'll see is what the resorts irrigate. The other side of the island is beyond wet. Around 150 inches of rain per year and nothing but waterfalls and rainforests.
You know a lot about Hawaii, Riley said. Have you spent a lot of time here?
My father owned a 300-acre ranch in North Kohala. Vernon and I spent a month there every summer when we were kids. Since I now own the ranch and we can't risk staying at a hotel without being recognized, I thought we'd stay on my property.
Vernon stepped off the plane with Wei and Bagus and stretched. He looked at Emerson.
Did you say we're going to the ranch?
Riley thought she heard some hesitation in Vernon's voice. What's wrong with the ranch? She asked.
Nothing, Vernon said. You're gonna love it. It's real pretty. It's only that some of the people in the community are a mite eccentric. By the way, you like cows, don't you?
Let me get this straight, Riley said. Where we're heading, you and Emerson are the normal ones? Wei and Bagus took a deep breath and smiled.
I am happy to be back in the Pacific. It has been my experience that the only normal people are those you don't know very well. In any event, I am quite fond of cows. The ranch sounds very nice.
A car was waiting for them on the tarmac. The keys were in the car, and four flower leis were on the dash. It was an hour's drive to the sleepy little town of Hawi in North Kohala. Riley headed out of the airport, turning left onto Route 19, the belt road that hugged the coastline and encircled the island. 20 minutes of lava fields later, they passed the Four Seasons Resort Hualalai, a man-made green oasis of golf courses, luxury homes, and bungalow-style $1,000-per-night hotel rooms. Vernon groaned as they passed.
I don't suppose the ranch has a hot tub, all-day room service, and somebody to bring you ice cream sundaes while you sit by the pool.
I don't suppose so, unless there have been some upgrades since we were there last. It does, however, have a tidal pool and a fruit orchard that's open 24 hours a day,
Emerson said.
Riley will probably be particularly interested in the tidal pool. She's a swimming enthusiast.
Riley cut her eyes to Emerson. Your time will come.
Are we almost there? Wei and Bagus asked. I would like to have some fruit and swim in the tidal pool and see the cows.
Not far now, Emerson said.
Riley continued north on Route 19, passing a number of other 4- and 5-star resorts. As she drove, the lava fields were slowly replaced with scrubby brown grass, arid patches of dirt, and the occasional tree. She turned onto a Koni Pule Highway and passed through Kawehi Harbor into North Kohala. As she rounded the northern tip of the island, the scrubby brown grass became progressively greener and more lush. Tall guinea grasses swayed in the trade winds. This is absolutely beautiful, Riley said as she drove through the little town of Hawi with its art galleries, restaurants, and little shops. Emerson pointed at an unmarked dirt road to their left.
It's about half a mile down this road.
Riley bumped down the road, avoiding potholes as best she could. After a couple minutes, the woods and brush opened up into open pasture land.
A herd of Black Angus cows looked up in a lazy greeting as their car passed under a sign reading, Mysterioso Ranch.
Oh, man, Vernon said. I hope we don't run into Alani.
Alani was Vernon's first girlfriend, Emerson said to Riley. She still lives in Hawi and works as an astronomer at the Keck Observatory. She and Vernon had a small difference of opinion, and Vernon hasn't been back here since.
She ran me over with an ATV, Vernon said. She's got anger issues.
Is she one of the eccentrics? Riley asked.
She's the eccentric, Vernon said.
Emerson looked at Vernon.
In fairness to her, that was preceded by the unspeakable incident.
Vernon leaned over the front seat and clapped his hand over Emerson's mouth.
Hello, it's called the unspeakable incident for a reason. Anyway, I'm sure she's forgotten all about it by now. It's been years, right?
Wayan Bagus rolled down his window to get a better look at the cows. It is written by the sage that never by hatred is hatred conquered, but by readiness to love. That is the eternal law.
I reckon the sage might feel differently if he had a girlfriend who ran him over with an ATV, Vernon said.
Riley parked the car in front of a small, one-story Bali-style house. It sat at the edge of a 100-foot sea cliff with the island of Maui in the distance, separated by the 30-mile-wide Ala Nui Haha Channel. Everyone got out of the car and stood in awe at the sight and sound of the 10-foot swells crashing into the cliffs below.
It's almost sunset, Emerson said to Vernon. Why don't you and Way and Bagus walk into town and buy us some food for dinner? I'll show Riley around the ranch.
Riley watched Vernon and Way and Bagus disappear down the driveway. Is this the only house on the property? She asked Emerson.
The ranch manager has a house here, and there's a larger house that my father preferred. This was built as a guest house, but I find the scale more comfortable than the main house. Vernon and Way and Bagus won't be gone long, but we can do a little exploring. Would you like to walk the perimeter of the property, or would you rather see the tidal pool?
The tidal pool?
Good choice, Emerson said.
The tidal pool has always been my favorite spot.
They walked along the cliff for a quarter of a mile in silence before coming to a deep gulch. Seabirds flew overhead trying to find their roosts before dark, and the occasional humpback whale breached just offshore.
There's a trail to the bottom, Emerson said. It's a little rough, but it's worth the effort. It's also the reason for the cowboy boots. That and the cows.
Riley followed Emerson down the muddy, slippery trail, and the pastures gave way to a lush rainforest that smelled of mango trees and freshly cut grass. Behind her, a 100-foot waterfall plunged down a green cliff into a stream hidden by the thick jungle. In front of her, the jungle opened up onto a rocky beach with a large pool fed half by the stream coming from the direction of the waterfall and half by the warmer ocean waves.
We used to swim here every day, Emerson said.
Riley put her hand into the pool. It was a perfect temperature.
Makes you want to jump in, doesn't it?
Emerson said.
Are you going to jump in?
No, Emerson said. Unfortunately, there's no time. We want to head back before we lose the light. The gulch gets super dark at night because of the double canopy of vegetation.
Thank goodness, Riley thought.
Plotting to catch Emerson and the altogether was one thing. Co-ed naked swimming was something entirely different. She wasn't ready for co-ed naked swimming. Her head was in other places. She had to save the world and make sure she didn't end up like Spiro.
How are we going to find the National Park Service Research Facility without getting killed? Riley asked.
No problem. Mauna Kea is very different from Yellowstone, Emerson said. Once you reach the higher elevations near the training area and the observatory, it's basically an arid, treeless moonscape.
Is that good or bad?
Emerson and Riley started back up the path out of the gulch.
A little of both, Emerson said. The good is that there's no place to hide an R&D facility, so it should be easier to find. The bad is that there's no place for us to hide either. I have a plan, but it requires a certain amount of diplomacy.
Riley looked at Emerson. Emerson was a lot of things, one of which was definitely not a diplomat.
We're doomed, Riley said.
My thoughts exactly, Emerson said. That's why I wanted to talk with you first without the others.
This is going to be good, Riley said. Let's hear it.
We need an inside man. Someone who can get us close to the Pohakuloa training area without arousing suspicion.
You have somebody in mind, Emerson nodded.
Alani.
Vernon's Alani? ATV Alani? Vernon's gonna freak out.
As long as we keep her away from motor vehicles, Vernon should be fine. More or less. She's an astronomer at the Keck Observatory. She can get us access to the Onizuka Center for International Astronomy.
What's the Onizuka Center? Riley asked.
It's basically a hotel for the astronomers. There are usually around 70 people there at any one time, so we should be able to blend into the background. As the crow flies, it sits about 4 miles up the mountain from Pohakuloa and about 7 miles from the dozen or so telescopes at the summit.
They left the gulch and crossed the meadow that led to the guest house. Cows were making cow sounds in the nearby paddock, and the sound of the surf was soft and rhythmic. It was all calming and wonderful if you could just keep your mind off the scary, psycho people who wanted to kill everyone, Riley thought. And then there was the Vernon and Alani thing. When are you going to tell Vernon about Alani? Riley asked Emerson.
As soon as possible. It's going to be an awkward conversation, so I came up with Plan B.
What's Plan B? Riley asked.
Send Vernon on an errand, invite Alani over to the house, and find someone tactful to babysit them after the reunion.
Would this errand happen to involve Vernon getting our dinner tonight? And would the babysitter happen to be me?
Yes, and yes.
Emerson opened the front door to the guest house and held it open for Riley.
Boy, I wouldn't want to be in your shoes, he said. I don't know how you get yourself into messes like this.
Riley shook her head. I ask myself the same thing every day. When can I expect to be in the middle of this new mess?
Now.
Chapter 21. The interior of the guest house was a scaled-down Hawaiian version of Mysterioso Manor. 4,000 square feet of over-the-top Bali-style furniture and assorted island-themed bric-a-brac. An 8-foot-tall tiki of a grimacing ku, the Hawaiian god of war, greeted them in the foyer. A pretty young woman of mixed Hawaiian and Asian ancestry was sitting in the living room reading a book. She jumped off the couch, rushed over to them, and punched Emerson in the shoulder.
Emerson Knight, I haven't seen you in years.
It's been too long, Emerson said.
Alani nodded.
Agreed. I have to say I was shocked to get your text asking me to meet with you.
She turned to Riley.
You must be Riley Moon. Emerson said he was traveling with you. Aloha.
Aloha, Riley said. Alani cut her eyes back to Emerson.
You're in trouble again, aren't you?
I suppose it's a matter of perspective, Emerson said. I prefer to think of it as an adventure. We're helping a friend find a stolen island, and we need help.
Alani shook her head.
That's what I thought. Trouble.
She paused for a moment, and her expression changed.
Wait just a friggin' second. You said we need help. Who's the we? Are you referring to Riley?
The front door banged open, and Vernon walked in, followed by Wei and Bagus.
Food's here, Vernon said. I got takeout from the bamboo restaurant.
Spotting Alani, he stopped in his tracks, his mouth dropped open, and the food bag slipped through his fingers and crashed onto the floor.
Surprise, Emerson said.
You,
Alani said, glaring at Vernon, fists clenched.
You!
I asked Alani to stop by, Emerson said to Vernon. I bet you're surprised, right?
Vernon had a red scald rising out of his shirt collar, staining his cheeks.
I couldn't be any more surprised than if I woke up in the hospital with tire tracks on my back.
Wayan Bagus stepped forward.
This is Wayan Bagus, Emerson said to Alani. He's the friend we're helping.
Wayan Bagus tugged at Vernon's shirt.
Isn't this nice, Vernon? The universe has provided you with an opportunity to heal the roots of the past.
Vernon shushed the little monk.
Ixnay on the talk about the Ast Pay, he whispered to Wei and Bagus.
Alani rolled her eyes.
Good grief. What did you tell him?
Vernon held up his hands.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
You didn't tell him about the unspeakable incident, did you? Because that wouldn't end well.
Riley looked at Vernon and Alani.
Okay, I have to know. What happened?
Wei and Bagus bowed politely.
Vernon accidentally superglued himself to Alani.
Vernon gasped and put his hand over his heart.
That was a confession. What happened to the sanctity of the confessional?
I know nothing of a confessional. I know only truth, Wei and Bagus said.
Vernon, you incredible nincompoop, Alani said. You're not even Catholic, and he's a Buddhist monk, not a priest.
It was dark. I thought it was lube, Vernon said. It was an accident. Ye should only took the paramedics 12 hours to get us separated. What's the big deal?
The big deal is I live in a town with a population of 1,000. It made the local newspaper. Everybody called me doggy-style Alani for a year.
Well, you ran me over with an ATV, Vernon said. That wasn't exactly a pleasant experience.
That was also an accident, Alani said.
That wasn't no accident. You ran over me twice, Vernon said. You're a wackadoodle.
I am not a wackadoodle. How dare you call me a wackadoodle?
This isn't going well, Riley said. Wei and Bagus picked up the food bag from the floor.
I will take Vernon into the kitchen and allow him to eat his dessert first.
Vernon made a crazy motion with his finger going around in circles, pointed it at Alani, and followed Wei and Bagus out of the room.
Vernon really didn't know it was glue, Emerson said. He always felt horrible about it.
I know, Alani said. It's just that seeing him so suddenly brought it all back.
We really need your help, Emerson said to Alani. I wouldn't ask if it wasn't important. Lives are at stake, including ours.
You don't even have to ask. I'm in. You guys are like family to me. Even the jackass in the next room who's missing most of his eyebrows. I don't even want to ask. Besides, I haven't had a good adventure since you stopped coming to Kahala. What do you need?
A room at the Onizuka with a view down the mountain and a telescope capable of spying on the runway at Bradshaw Army Airfield.
Do you think we beat Tin Man and the director to Hawaii? Riley asked Emerson. Emerson nodded.
I checked the FAA website. There haven't been any inbound flights landing at Bradshaw in the past 48 hours. Of course, they might not have filed a flight plan.
The entire base has been buried in the inversion layer under thick cloud cover for the past 3 days, Alani said. Visibility is zero, and as far as I know, there haven't been any inbound or outbound flights. This is an entirely different weather system from Kona.
Perfect. All we have to do is wait for the bad guys to arrive and use our telescope to track them to their secret lair, all from the safety of our first-class accommodations at the Onizuka.
It's a moldy, cramped room with 4 bunk beds and the combined stench of 1,000 dirty, tired scientists, Alani said.
Then we'll do it from the safety of our barely third-class accommodations, Emerson said. The plan is still sound, even if it doesn't smell the best.
Riley raised her hand. Except for one small detail, what do you intend to do after you find out where they've taken the penning trap?
Penning trap? Alani asked.
I'll explain it all later, Emerson said. It's complicated and barely believable.
About the plan? Riley said. Emerson rocked back on his heels.
It's a bit fluid at the moment.
Riley narrowed her eyes. Fluid?
Trust me. What could possibly go wrong?
1 hour later, Alani had organized a 3-day stay for all of them at Onizuka, and Riley had checked the weather report for Pohakuloa. The cloud cover was expected to dissipate by the next morning, and the airfield would be open for business. Vernon and Wei and Bagus were eating in another room. Emerson had disappeared. Riley looked up from her iPad.
"Where's Emerson?" she asked Alani. "He went into the master bedroom to pack supplies and meditate. He said he needed some private time to come up with an idea that didn't involve Macaulay Culkin."
Riley shook her head. "He's not normal." Alani smiled.
"You like him, don't you? I thought I sensed a spark between the two of you.
He's the most irritating person I've ever met."
"And you like him?"
"He is constantly getting me into trouble. Did I mention he got me fired from my last job?"
"And you like him?" Riley sighed. "Yes, maybe. I don't know. He has his moments. It's just that some of those moments make me want to punch him in the face."
"What about you? Did you and Emerson ever have a thing?"
"No, we were always just friends. I had a thing for Vernon. He has his moments, too."
Riley checked her watch. "We should be moving on. I'm going to see if I can help Emerson pack." She left the living room and walked down the short hall to the master bedroom. The door was ajar, and she could hear Emerson pacing. She pushed the door open, stepped into the room, and came face to face with Vernon in the buff.
"Crap on a cracker," she said, clapping her hands over her eyes. "What are you doing in here?"
"I was using Em's shower. It's better than the one in the guest room."
Riley peeked at him from between two fingers. "Okay, I guess I get that, but why are you still naked standing in the middle of the room flapping your arms?"
"I like to air dry. It's real refreshing, and it keeps my skin all silky smooth. I got a butt like a baby. I guess you already noticed that."
"I didn't notice anything."
Riley spun around and fled the room. Alani and Way and Bagus were in the living room when Riley rushed in.
"Are you okay?" Alani asked Riley. "Your face is flushed."
"I just saw Vernon naked."
Vernon followed Riley into the room. He was still damp, and he was wearing a towel.
"Yep, she saw my doodles and my dongle in all their glory," he said.
Alani gave a bark of laughter.
"Your dongle isn't that glorious. I've seen it, along with half the women on this island. You've got a teeny weeny."
Not that Riley had seen hundreds of dongles, but from what she'd just seen of Vernon, he looked pretty darn good from head to toe, dongle included. Emerson walked into the room.
"What's going on?"
"Riley saw Vernon naked," Wayne Bagus said. "Furthermore, Alani thinks Vernon has a teeny weeny."
"It was an accident," Riley said. "I thought Emerson was in the bedroom."
"I've heard about this on HBO, Vernon said. "It's a fetish called CFNM, or clothed female, nude male. Apparently some women just like to look at as many wieners as they can. You're probably next, little buddy."
Wayne Bagus shook his head and looked disapprovingly at Riley. "Not good. Not good at all."
"Criminy," Riley said. "I don't want to see everyone's wiener. I only wanted to see Emerson."
Emerson glanced down at himself.
"And who could blame her?"
Chapter 22. By 5 a.m., Riley, Emerson, Vernon, Wayne Bagus, and Alani were loaded into the ranch SUV and passing through the cowboy town of Waimea on their way to the Mauna Kea summit.
"The turnoff to Saddle Road is just ahead," Alani said. "It's about 25 miles from there to the Pohakuloa training area and another 10 miles from there to the Mauna Kea access road and the Onizuka Center."
Riley wound her way up the mountain road in the darkness and felt her ears pop.
"How high are we going?" she asked Alani.
"Waimea is at 2,600 feet elevation. Pohakuloa is about 9,000 feet. The summit is almost at 14,000 feet. It's usually below freezing there through the night, and in winter it's not uncommon to have snow."
By 5:30 a.m., the thick cloud cover was right above them.
"It's called an inversion layer," Emerson said. "The temperature difference keeps a dense cloud over Mauna Kea at this elevation most of the time."
Riley drove into the cloud. Even with the high beams, it was almost impossible to see more than a foot or two in front of the car.
"This is kind of spooky," she said, as the car passed a sign reading Pohakuloa Training Area.
Riley slowed and looked off to the side of the road. The visibility was so bad she couldn't see a single building, let alone the Army airfield.
There's no way a plane could land in this soup, Riley said, especially if you're carrying cargo that could explode if you jostled it the wrong way.
That's what I'm counting on, Emerson said. There's an 8-hour window tomorrow when the sky will be clear. I'm betting our friends try to land with a penning trap during that window.
5 minutes later, the car popped through the clouds, and the impenetrable white ceiling turned into an impenetrable white floor. Riley looked up into the pre-dawn sky.
Wow, I've never seen so many stars.
Alani smiled.
Mauna Kea is the world's largest observatory for optical, infrared, and sub-millimeter astronomy for a reason. The atmospheric conditions at the summit are near perfect.
A couple minutes later, Riley turned onto the summit access road and climbed steadily until reaching the Onizuka Center, where the paved road ended.
There's a very steep 5-mile-long gravel road to the summit from here, Alani said.
It requires a 4-wheel drive.
The sun was just beginning to peek above the horizon, and they all got out of the car. The air was noticeably thinner, and even walking up the small hill to the center was a workout. Only Wei and Bagus and Emerson seemed unaffected.
Vernon put his hands on his knees.
It's kind of hard to breathe proper up in this here high country, Vernon said. We all need to be alert for signs of altitude sickness, Emerson said. We haven't had time to acclimate. Mauna Kea is probably the only place in the world where you can go from sea level to 14,000 feet in less than 2 hours.
Alani led them to their dormitory.
The air is even thinner at the summit. Most of the observatories make the scientists spend a night or two at the center before using the telescopes.
Why? Riley asked.
There's 40% less oxygen up at the top than at sea level, and it can seriously mess with everything from your vision to your mental condition.
Interesting, Vernon said. Suppose a person worked where she was chronically deprived of oxygen. Would that cause a perfectly normal person to go all loopy and run over her boyfriend with a motor vehicle?
Alani cut her eyes to Vernon. You're a chronic jackass.
Vernon watched Alani walk inside the dormitory.
Okay, so I might be a chronic jackass, but that's no reason not to like me. Some people even think I'm a fun jackass.
Wayan Bagus put his hand on Vernon's shoulder.
It is written by the sage that you yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection.
Thanks, little buddy, Vernon said. Right back at you.
Alani returned with the key and handed it to Emerson.
You're all set. I have to get to work at the observatory. Call me on my cell if you need anything.
Alani had given them an accurate description of the dormitory room. It was a small, serviceable room with 2 sets of bunk beds and a distant view of the Bradshaw Army airfield. A telescope had been placed on a tripod next to the window. Wei and Bagus looked around the room and out the window. The sun was up, and the clouds had disappeared, revealing a breathtaking view of South Kahala all the way to the Pacific Ocean.
This is very nice, Wei and Bagus said. I've never been on a stakeout. I'm having such a good time saving the world that I almost don't care if we find my stolen island.
We'll find it,
Emerson said, peering through the telescope and adjusting it to focus on the runway. Now what? Riley asked.
We wait,
Emerson said. Over the next several hours, a steady stream of airplanes landed on the airstrip, but none were carrying cargo or any passengers wearing park ranger uniforms. Vernon groaned and tilted his head back.
Here's something they don't tell you about stakeouts. They're really, really boring. It's about to get really, really exciting,
Emerson said, turning the telescope over to Riley. Riley focused on a medium-sized jet taxiing down the runway. It had 2 crossed sabers and a number 1 above them painted on the side of the plane. For a secret society, they're not very good at keeping themselves under the radar, Riley said.
Pure arrogance, Emerson said. They've been an untouchable secret quasi-military unit for the past 100 years and don't think anybody can take them out. What chance do we have then?
Vernon asked. Emerson watched the plane pull up to the terminal and power down.
If we can expose the secret they're protecting, they'll no longer be useful and will become more of a liability than an asset.
They're crazy, Riley said. If we expose them, they'll destroy Yellowstone and who knows what else. You heard Spiro. He said we'd find Armageddon waiting for us in Hawaii. I don't know what that means, but it sounds really bad.
Emerson focused the telescope on the plane's door.
Then we'll just have to steal the superweapon they're creating here on Hawaii, find a way to neutralize Tin Man, and then expose the secret to the world.
Yeah, that sounds like a walk in the park. We can do that no problemo, Riley said. And then we can end world hunger by growing tomatoes on the moon.
The plane's door opened, and Emerson watched as the pilots walked down the stairs and waited for the passengers to disembark.
They're coming out now, Emerson said. It's Tin Man and Bart Young. An SUV is driving onto the tarmac to meet them. And now two Rough Riders wearing khaki uniforms and campaign hats are unloading something from the cargo storage into the SUV.
Is it the penning trap? Riley asked.
It's a crate, but it's the right size to contain the penning trap.
Emerson watched as Tin Man and Bart Young climbed into the SUV with the two soldiers. They drove through the airfield's gate and onto Saddle Road. After a quarter mile, the SUV turned left onto a rough jeep trail and headed into the barren wasteland.
Where are they going? Riley asked. The army base is in the other direction. There's nothing where they're heading but lava desert.
Emerson watched them drive for a couple more minutes in silence.
Well, that's interesting.
You found their base?
Emerson looked up from the telescope and turned to face Riley.
Not exactly. It turns out there is some place to hide. They've disappeared.
Riley looked through the telescope. There was still a cloud of dust where the SUV had passed, but no SUV. She scanned the surrounding area. Nothing but miles and miles of desert, without a structure in sight.
That's impossible, she said.
It's improbable, Emerson said. Clearly it's possible, because it happened. Maybe that SUV is with Little Buddy's Island, Vernon said, like they both got sucked into one of them black holes and got spit out someplace else.
Emerson returned to the telescope.
What do you think happened to the SUV?
He asked Riley.
Riley allowed herself a grimace. I've got nothing.
So what are we going to do now? Vernon asked. Do we go out to look for the black hole?
Emerson lay down on one of the bunk beds.
Nothing. We do nothing. The universe will provide the answer.
We can't sit around in this hotel room forever, Wu Wei waiting on the universe, Riley said. We're sort of in a time crunch. Tin Man plans to destroy Sour Creek Dome in less than a week if we don't either get ourselves killed or stop him first.
Emerson closed his eyes.
We don't have to sit around forever,